Hi, everyone. I'm Natalie Gochner. I represent the political center. This is Both Sides of the Aisle, and I have with me on the political left, Shireen Gorbani.
Hello, and hey to the listeners.
And on the political right, Senator Dan McKay. Hi, Dan.
Hello, and hey to the listeners.
We are glad you're here.
And we have a lot to talk about, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on it because we did it last week, but let's talk about the end of the war in Afghanistan. It probably surprised the two of you like it did me to see the U.S. Meet their deadline by, you know, several hours before. And I don't know if you saw the picture of the last military leader in our country leaving Afghan soil, but that was a pretty sobering shot. Did you see that, Dan?
I did. Yeah. The infrared image of
General. Just leaving.
Spooky.
But rather than, you know, go into the things we did last week, I just thought I'd ask. President Biden gave a lengthy speech this week where he really made his case for why he made the decision, what the choices were. And in the process, he really just signaled the end to U.S. nation building through war. And I think that's a powerful policy statement that he's making, a Biden doctrine, if you will. Shireen, he did what Bush 43, Obama, and Trump wanted to do but didn't do, and that was end this war.
That's right. This is a... I just can't let this moment go by without acknowledging that we lost a Marine from Utah, Sergeant Taylor Hoover, who was 31 years old, was one of 13 service members killed in a blast since the last time that we recorded, along with 175 Afghans. And I need to acknowledge that moment. And I also just have to say that I don't believe that our military, I don't believe our military force is the way that we build nations. And this is incredibly difficult. This is absolutely heart-wrenching for individuals. I was with an individual tonight who is in this country, a student at Westminster who has Afghan, who has family still left in Afghanistan. And when we think about just the very real consequences of this for individual families, it is absolutely gut-wrenching. And that is the case. And I do not believe that what we were doing there made sense from a military perspective. And I don't believe that when we think about what it means to build democracy, to do nation building, I don't think that's what our military is for. And I just need to acknowledge how difficult and how awful this situation is for so many. And I think this was the right decision.
Hmm. Dan, what's your commentary on nation building through war? And were you surprised when one of the 13 was from Utah?
Well, we have so many of our National Guardsmen and troops who live here in Utah and are stationed and have been stationed over in Afghanistan. You'll remember Major Brent Taylor, who was a mayor up in North Ogden. He was killed in Afghanistan a couple of years ago. And, you know, and here, you know, we're adding another tragic loss. And war is, gosh, man, it's really just, it just sucks.
It's hell
all the way around. It really is, you know?
Yeah.
And if you've never been in a situation where you've, you know, had to fight or trained or any of those things and been deployed, it's a tough situation. I remember as a kid, my dad would disappear for 8-9 months at a time in a submarine for somewhere in the Pacific Ocean. And we had no idea where he was. And then they'd pop up and we'd hear from him somewhere, you know? It was an interesting deal. But, you know, I do want to talk about America's plan to get out. And I don't know if it was a Trump presidency or if it was a Biden presidency. I'm not really concerned about like the blame factor. Eventually we're going to have to get there. But how do we leave? You know, they said that we left over 250 militarized aircraft on the ground in Afghanistan. We left more than 200 fully armed vehicles, tanks, Humvees, etc., on the ground in Afghanistan. I mean, you look at the and then uncounted numbers of automatic rifles and those kinds of things. You look at what that really is that we've left behind, and in some ways, you can argue that we've left Afghanistan worse than we found it. Mm-hmm. Where we had a completely ragtag, you know, fractionalized army, and, you know, or Taliban and ISIS. And in it, we've now placed a complete vacuum of leadership and we've armed them.
So this isn't the beginning of that, though. We've been doing that for years, for decades. And I do think that this is a serious concern. But I also feel like it's a greater question about corruption. It's a greater question about what it means, again, going back to the kind of the core question that Natalie posed, what it means to try to build nations through our military and investing billions of dollars, $300 million a day into an army that fell in hours. But I mean, there are real key questions here about what it means for us as the United States to engage in this kind of warfare for sustained periods of time with absolutely no exit strategy. It is a humanitarian disaster, absolutely. I'm terribly sorry for what is happening, but this is, and I think, Dan, you're right, this is beyond partisanship. It is about American imperialism and what it actually costs us.
But look at, I don't know if I'm looking to Bill Maher for commentary of sanity.
Which you do regularly, right?
Which I do regularly, right? So you know that, you know, I'm out on, you know, on a fringe loop here on the right wing side. But Bill Maher, you know, he gave a great commentary, really, you know, I understand the balance, or I guess I don't say understand it, but I understand your concerns about nation building with the military. Bill Maher this last week, you know, he had a great commentary. It was a minute and a half dialogue with himself, really, just talking about how everyone, you know, and this will be very popular, but the woke mob that lives on Twitter, the woke mob that lives out there just ready to persecute somebody for being one thing or another, it ought to really take a serious inventory of where they're at when they look at the atrocities that we had in Afghanistan prior to, you know, going in there with the military. If you look at the human rights tragedies that are happening in and around the world, it doesn't matter where it is. And he had a long list of these very, you know, detailed places. And you have to stop and think. It's the question Natalie kind of asked last week. Does the world really need a police officer? And if so, how does that police officer act in such a way that we leave the place better than we found it? That, I think, is the key policy objective we ought to be looking forward to instead of, you know, who's at fault, I guess.
And I do think what is confusing about this moment is that ultimately what Biden did is what Trump was trying to do. And so there is a space in, again, across partisanship that says this was not working. And mm-hmm. what we do going forward will be a very interesting picture.
Yeah. And I also think, Shireen, you know, the military, I don't think of them as Republican or Democrat. I think of them as our military that served the commander in chief. And I have a hard time believing that the evacuation would have been much better under a Republican president, because you have the same military and the same reality. Maybe some things could have been better executed, but in the end, it was an unbelievably difficult situation. Hey, yeah. But let's transition from, nation building to the huge, big heart of Utah as we start to accept more refugees. We have such an incredible state in this way. Give huge props to the International Rescue Committee and Catholic Community Services that help with all this resettlement. It's my understanding, Dan, that we got our first, what would you call it, special immigrant visa holder from Afghanistan. A gentleman that was a air traffic controller at the Kabul airport who, worked with NATO and the U.S. military, and they got him out of there. He had to leave his wife and, mother-in-law, brothers behind. My understanding is that they've now been able to get them out of the country, and he'll be reunified with his family not too long. But really touching that our state's starting to help with the huge service that needs to be lent to these people.
Well, and it's going to be a lot of service. I mean, when you look at what is going to be needed to, you know, to deal with and compensate for really the loss to the community, you know, in these countries, it is going to be a long haul for everyone. It really is. And that's the worst part about these human rights tragedies where you have refugees. I shudder at the idea that people say we ought to just leave them where they are because, man, some of these people that come here, they're just so grateful to be here and offer so much and in a lot of ways.
Shireen, the expectation is that we'll have a couple hundred newcomers in the coming weeks or months.
Yeah, and something I just want to encourage people to understand is that over the Trump administration and then also in the beginning of the Biden administration, we've seen significantly reduced numbers of refugees that were accepted into this country. Utah, Salt Lake, is one of 19 cities that's been identified for the resettlement of Afghans. And right now, there is something that everyone can do. So if you are interested, if you care about this issue, you can put together welcome packets. You can help people. You can pick people up from the airport. I mean, they are looking for volunteers to do housing, long-term housing, short-term housing, and everything in between, including putting together care packages for individuals who are resettling here. We have a deep and long history. It's one of the things I'm most proud of, and I think is one of the least partisan areas of the state, is we do believe that the United States should have open arms to refugees and immigrants to this country, and there's a lot of ways that people can get involved.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Natalie Gochner with Dan McKay and Shireen Gourbani. Stay tuned. We're going to talk some more local news in our second segment.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Shireen Gourbani on the left.
Dan McKay on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. You are listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. We've been talking about Afghanistan, and I think it's worth taking a little bit of time and talking again about COVID, with the angle being that we have a governor and a legislature that are, you know, what would you call co-branches of government, Dan? Is that the way they like to think of themselves?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, it's checks and balances, right? So yeah, co-branches, but you have an executive branch anyways, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, and here we have, you know, an ICUs in this state at a near breaking point. Utah's COVID cases of school-aged children are 3.5 times higher at the beginning of this school year than last. You know, the projections are not looking good. I think there's numbers that say we should have between 25 and 63,000 cases in September alone. I can't imagine what this is like for our healthcare workers. And I haven't shared this news very broadly, and I didn't tell you, Dan and Shireen, that it was on my mind, but consumer confidence in the state, which we measure at the Gardner Institute, has plummeted in August. So, you know, if you're Governor Cox, you've got a big problem brewing. And as it's brewing, you have fewer tools to deal with from the executive branch, because the legislatures said, hey, you don't have the executive powers that Herbert did, and we want to partner with you in doing this. And apparently, instead of taking a bold proposal to the legislature, he's basically just sharing data and saying, what are you guys thinking? Dan, let's get your expertise there, because I'm... You know, I guess I border on thinking I would need a strong chief executive here.
Yeah, you know, I think, though, the governor wisely in my book is choosing the long road, right? Which is, the last governor chose not to bring the legislature along with him, and it caused a bunch of problems. He failed to communicate. He failed to, the list goes on of the early pandemic responses. Unfortunately, it caused, you know, some early mistakes, whatever it might be, you know, which, as Natalie always reminds us, nobody looks good in a pandemic. But I'd say that, you know, this governor, on the other hand, wants to have a great relationship with legislative leadership and with the legislature, and he's trying to bring everybody along. And I know everybody probably sees that as, you know, maybe, you know, I heard someone complain that it wasn't leadership. And I said, actually, I think it is leadership, right? Bringing people along is leadership. Dragging mm-hmm. them is not.
Yeah. And there's that mantra, you know, if you want to go far, go slow. And sometimes it takes a little longer if you're going to bring the legislature along with you and have those. And I'm not meaning to, you know, slight the leadership. I'm just meaning to say that in a pandemic, however that leadership manifests itself, you've got to act. You can't stand on the sidelines. Shireen?
Yeah, so I'm really concerned that we are seeing reports in the Salt Lake Tribune just today, I believe, where, you know, we've got our Senate president saying, I think what we're doing is working. And I can tell you that healthcare leaders in this state are suggesting, based on data and based on what's happening in our hospital system, otherwise. So, you know, Dan, I really am curious, like, what is it going to take for what seems to me like an unbelievably partisan response to a, I know that it's become this way, but a nonpartisan issue, like, what is it going to take for our legislature to really look at the fact that we're over 100% capacity in our ICUs again? We are in a situation for our schools that is looking pretty dire. And if it continues on this trajectory, we're going to be seeing more and more kids in pretty high risk health situations. What is it going to take to see action from this body?
Well, and Dan, as Shireen says, that I just want to add to you that in my judgment, the governor will get all the blame here. In other words, you know, when you have, you know, all these legislators that represent so many different people in the state, it's hard for it to be thought of as a monolith. And really what you count on is your chief executive to lead. And so as the legislature, if they don't help solve this problem, I think more of the blame will be put on the governor than on them.
Interesting. You know, I think that's an interesting perspective, Natalie and Shireen. You know, I, boy, it's tough. And that's all I can tell you. Like, that's all I can tell you is there is a lot of informing, and there are a lot of conversations going on where, you know, actively trying to figure out the right path forward. And at the same time, you know, what are we going to do? Shireen, and I ask this of
I got some ideas
leadership all the time.
Yeah.
Well,
if we
come out with a mask mandate, what we're going to be? Are we going to start policing? You know what I mean? Like,
we didn't before either, and it did change behavior.
And while I don't take away that it did change behavior, I'm just telling you, like, from the sake of where people are now in the pandemic response, cases are up, right, among children. We do not see a greater, you know, mortality rate, and we're actually seeing, you know, those that are dying of COVID-19 and even the Delta variant, it is the unvaccinated. So at some point, right, you just have to step back and say, when is the government doing something actually more detrimental? Because if people from a crowdsource level get the idea because a neighbor, and I've actually seen this just recently in my neighborhood, where a gentleman who was very anti-vax, very, you know, had very strong positions, did not get vaccinated, went to the hospital, recently passed away, and as a result of COVID-19. And I've seen a lot of people who said, man, you who were, I'm not getting a vaccine, to now it's impacted them and they're like going to get a vaccine.
Okay, but I have to back up.
So I say that makes a bigger difference and it is really the right thing to do, because okay, government taking away people's agency is uncomfortable to me.
Okay, that's a terrible loss, and I just want to acknowledge that. And then I also have to say, Dan, you asked a really interesting question, which was, you know, at what point is government being more hurtful than they are being helpful in this context? I have been asking that question about your party for quite a while. And I really am concerned that what we are seeing right now in our state is tied to what is happening with Republicans. It is a small segment of people on the left who are anti-vax. We are talking about an absolute crisis in the Republican Party when it comes to, and in particular, actually men who will not go get the vaccine. And I'm just like, we have to put this into context and understand that this is not about government. This is about an absolutely destructive and toxic situation that has been created by deep partisanship. We have numerous examples of people on the right, on the radio. I'm sure you've seen these stories too. Numerous people now across this country who are anti-vax on the radio talking about it nonstop have now lost their lives. I don't want your neighbor to have to die. I don't want other Republicans in this state to have to die. What is it going to take for there to be an actual reckoning with a level of misinformation on the right?
Hmm. You know, Shireen and Dan, let me jump in from the middle and just say this, though. I mean, everybody wants to prevent harm, but what's happening is there is a building ideology, I think, in the right and to some degree the center, that our efforts to defeat this or eradicate COVID-19, that it's not going to happen, that the virus is becoming endemic and manageable. And so you have to adopt what they would call a harm reduction strategy. and you're basically trying to reduce the likelihood that the virus causes hospitalization or death. And so immunization's the best thing.
Right.
But the next best thing is to avoid these one-size-fits-all mitigation strategies and defer to very local jurisdictions and individuals. I mean, that's the ideology that I'm hearing from the right.
Sure. But Natalie, I would also ask, you know, I mean, I think what you noted about consumer confidence is a real part of this equation. I think if we start to see very detrimental economic impacts again, that maybe we'll see action. But I'm curious what you think it's going to take.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I would say that even more than the economic, I think if you start to see kids in harm's way.
That's happening.
Yeah.
Well, yes. But, you know, you'll also have to weigh, you know, some of what's going on. And I think, Natalie, you put it best, right? It's that balancing of harm reduction and it's endemic. You know, those are great words to really describe where we are. And, you know, from a manageable standpoint, COVID-19 is probably going to be with us in some way, shape, or another for a long time. All sure. of the experts are saying that.
Sure.
I want to hear our public health officials weigh in on that more because I'm still have this hope that we can get past it, but maybe we're too far. Hey, Dan and Shereen, I want to also ask you about the Department of Education. They, you know, sent a letter, a threatening letter, and, you know, the way it's characterized is from the Biden administration to our State Office of Education, but they're basically making the point that our universal mask prohibition at the state level is violating the civil rights of students with disabilities. And Shereen, I'm going to let you talk about this first, but I know what Dan's rebuttal is going to be.
Yeah, so basically what it's saying is that there are students. So right now, many of our schools are not offering a remote learning option because they were told by the state legislature that we're going back to school. And there is effectively, though I think there will be some argument about this, there's effectively a ban on having mask mandates for children 12 and under right now. So what they are saying is that for kids who are at high risk, they are at home. And they don't really have an option. And so it's violating their civil rights in terms of having access to a public education.
Mm, yeah. Dan, let's hear your rebuttal.
Well, the problem with calling it effective is it's not actually effective.
And except for it has been very effective, hasn't it?
And it hasn't, at the end of the day, proven to be, you know, the actuality of things. You have other counties who are looking at, you know, instituting a mask mandate in their counties. And I think, you know, you look at the local solutions that can come out of this thing. And I think we're going to be far better if we continue to let local solutions provide for and deal with these issues rather than it being a top-down strategy.
Dan, let's go to you on this. What did you think about the University of Utah, USU, Weber State, and UVU requiring COVID-19 vaccinations for students?
Yeah, and just for clarity, they have to offer an opt-out, right? So they, you know, students still have the right to opt out and not take it for, I think it's personal and religious, and I think there was one other health reasons potentially. But yeah, I mean, you know, look, this is a public institution, it's public property, you know, and they're within the rights now that the COVID-19 vaccine is at least one of them, and I know I'm going to get which one wrong.
Pfizer.
Is it Moderna or Pfizer? There we go.
Pfizer, yeah.
But, you know, now that it's no longer experimental or emergency approved, it's actually, you know, fully approved, it changed the status of it. And yeah. We do require vaccines in different components all the time.
Shereen, you used to work at the University of Utah. You know how much this this policy change, how warmly that would be welcomed on campus.
Yeah, so I do think that this is a population that is, you know, vaccinated, and I think that it kind of helps move us towards a safer reentry into the fall.
Yeah, it does. Hey, Dan, we've got to talk about Mia Love. You are a good friend of the former congresswoman. She's been extended an invitation to be on a rotating group of conservatives on The View. It's an ABC daytime show that I have never seen, so I'm not anyone good to comment here. But I heard Mia Love on radio speaking about this new opportunity, and she's very articulate. She stands on her own 2 feet on issues. Shereen, she takes on the Trump administration, says exactly how she feels about things. I think she'll be a really great addition. And Dan, have you talked to her since she got this ask?
You know, we've texted a little bit, but I'm excited for her. I mean, at the end of the day, Mia is a good talent, and she is a strong voice for conservative values and very intelligent. So I think she's going to do a phenomenal job, and I might actually watch the show. I mean, it's terrible to admit. I have actually never seen The View either, so I have that going for us.
Shereen, we're in the final seconds.
I'm not a watcher, but I wish her the best.
Yeah, that's great. I have seen her, you know, stand up to some very smart, articulate business leaders on an issue that she cared about. She's a very smart woman, and she'll do a great job on The View. So I'm looking forward to it.
We better wrap it up there. I'm Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. I've been with Shereen Gourbani on the left, Dan McKay on the right. Programs produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks, everybody, for listening.